It's such a huge privilege to be in dialogue with you.
The privilege and the pleasure is all mine.
That's so kind. I've admired you for years.
I've admired you for years.
I wasn't expecting a retort. Elif is very funny, and I take your humor very seriously. There was a 2006 essay that you wrote. It's called Short Story and Novel. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who haven't read it, Short Story and Novel was published in N+1 magazine.
Yeah.
And it's Elif's kind of exegesis of the state of American literature, the short story and novel. And I wanted to read one paragraph from that essay because it always kind of stuck with me. And so this is another means of introducing Elif as an extraordinary essayist. So the paragraph reads, quote, "Writers feeling guilty for not doing any real work, that mysterious activity, where is it? On Wall Street, at Sloan Kettering, in Sudan, turn in shame to the notion of writing as craft. If art is aristocratic, decadent, egotistical, self-indulgent, then craft is useful, humble, ascetic, anorexic, a form of whittling. Craft solicits from them constipated vignettes, as if to say, well, yes, it's bad, but at least there isn't too much of it. As if writing well consisted of overcoming human weakness and bad habits. As if writers became writers by omitting needless words." So, I love this essay.
Oh, thank you. But
this passage always struck me not... Yeah, that's better. Thank you. This passage always struck me not for the obvious reasons. I think we're going to be talking a little bit today about college. I was once in college. I was pre-med. I studied biology, which is to say that I wanted to be a pediatrician, a heroic pediatrician in, say, Sudan.
Right.
Alas, I'm not a pediatrician in Sudan.
Are your parents doctors?
I have six aunts who are doctors. So I live with a lot
Both
of that shame.
Both my aunts are doctors, yeah.
Both, yeah. So I live with a lot of that shame. So shame is a theme that I wanted to come back to vis-a-vis craft.
Yeah.
But first, we can talk about The Idiot. I don't know how many of you in the room have actually read Elif's novel. Good, so this will inspire you to read it. The Idiot is so many things. It's a Bildungsroman. That word always sounds pretentious.
Not to me.
It's a campus novel. It's a crush book. I've been calling it a picaresque to myself because there are physical adventures, intellectual adventures, and spiritual adventures. It's also a historical novel of a sort. It's set in 1995, which is to say the Stone Age. Much has been made of the book's opening scene, which very vividly recounts the protagonist's first encounter with email. There are other historical timestamps. There are mixtapes in the book. There's Blues Traveler on the Discman. Things that might make you wince if you were alive, I think, and young at that period. And finally, I would say The Idiot is also a book about art and about faith, and that's going to be one of, I think, the themes of today's talk. The Idiot's heroine is named Celine, no relation to the French author. It's a Turkish name. She's a teenager. In the words of the author, she's, quote, an American teenager, the world's least interesting and dignified kind of person. So why, you might ask, or I might ask, would you devote 423 pages to this least interesting type of person? And if you're reading on your iPhone, as I did, I think the book is 847 pages. So Celine is also a freshman at Harvard. She's Turkish-American. She's raised in New Jersey. She's the product of doctor parents, or at least parent. In other words, she bears more than a passing resemblance to the book's author. She's also uncommonly tall, and Elif, you are also uncommonly tall.
You're also uncommonly tall.
I am also uncommonly tall.
Yeah.
But I like how you didn't even scramble her height.
Yeah.
You kept her tall. Celine has one especially charismatic friend at Harvard, Svetlana. And Svetlana is the child of Eastern European psychoanalysts. She has very vivid dreams, like about burritos as phalluses, and she has thoughts about everything, it turns out.
Yeah, she does. Big thinker.
And then there's Ivan. He's a tall, ponderous, enigmatic mathematician from Hungary. He's a senior to Celine's freshman, and she's very taken by him. So there is a love story that we can talk about. Céline takes courses in linguistics, in Russian for beginners, and she even dips into conceptual art through a class called Constructed Worlds. And I think Constructed Worlds is a theme that runs through the book. She wants to be a writer, and this conviction is, quote, completely independent of my having ever written anything or being able to imagine ever writing anything that I thought anyone would like to read. She is nevertheless an extraordinary observer of people's bodies, habits, and certainly the gaps between what people say about the world and the way she experiences it. I think she has a very compelling, overcrowded mind that isn't willing yet, at least, to privilege the inherited narratives that she's handed down at Harvard. So this book could be called, I'm poaching the title of another much talked about book, which I shamefully haven't read, How Should a Person Be? Or How to Live, or How to Live Meaningfully. So we promised to talk about faith today, which I guess I thought would be especially interesting in the context of an art fair, where there are a lot of inherited narratives about art, the canon, what matters, about value. All of which puts me in the mind of an Emily Dickinson quote that I don't know if you've heard before, but throughout the book I was thinking of nature is a haunted house, but art a house that tries to be haunted. Anyway, you can think about that. But so Elif, I wanted to ask you if you could perhaps read a passage that might set the tone a little bit and introduce us to Céline and this sort of disconnect that she has, or alienation with the world, and then we can take it from there.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me without it? No. Okay. Thank you. You know, it's funny when you talked about... Now can you hear me? When you were talking about keeping her height, there was a time where I was actually talking to Sheila Hetty about how should a person be, and talking to her about why do you call her Sheila and not something else, and why didn't you... And I was wondering, should I change... Because I didn't want her to be called Elif, and I was wondering if I should change anything. And I was living in Istanbul at the time, and I had a friend who was also Elif, which was really disorienting because I grew up in New Jersey where there's no other Elifs. And she was also a writer, and we lived in the same neighborhood, so I would see her every now and then. And she was just this wonderful, delightful person who was like a hard-hitting labor journalist. Like, she was writing about the Union of the Cleaning Ladies, and she had an enormous chest, and like every time I would see her, like I would just see her like around Istanbul. And then so then I thought I would give the character of my book like an enormous bosom, and that would just differentiate her from me. But then I started trying to do it, and I realized that just so much would change, you know, like you would be a different person, and it would start when you were, you know, 11 or 12 or whenever, and like your life would start to become different. But I just had that thought that like maybe if we had more robust bosoms, our microphones would be a little closer to our mouths, but they're not, so we have... I'm sorry, you're welcome. Okay, I'm just gonna read a little bit from the beginning. So it's about her first year in college. This is about, where is this? Okay, her roommate's name is Hannah. Hannah bought a refrigerator for the common room. She said I could use it if I bought something for the room too, like a poster. I asked what kind of poster she had in mind. Psychedelic, she said. I didn't know what a psychedelic poster was, so she showed me her psychedelic notebook. It had a fluorescent tie-dyed spiral with purple lizards walking around the spiral and disappearing into the center. What if they don't have that? I asked. Then a photograph of Albert Einstein, she said decisively, as if it were the obvious next choice. Albert Einstein? Yeah, one of those black and white pictures, you know, Einstein. The campus bookstore turned out to have a huge selection of Albert Einstein posters. There was Einstein at a blackboard, Einstein in a car, Einstein sticking out his tongue, Einstein smoking a pipe. I didn't totally understand why we had to have an image of Einstein on the wall, but it was better than buying my own refrigerator. The poster I got was no better or worse than the other Einstein posters in any way that I could see, but Hannah seemed to dislike it. Hmm, she said. I think it'll look good there. She pointed to the space over my bookshelf. But then you can't see it.
That's okay. It goes best there. From that day on, everyone who happened by our room, neighbors wanting to borrow stuff, residential computer staff, student council candidates, all kinds of people to whom my small enthusiasm should have been a source of little or no concern, all went out of their way to disabuse me of my great admiration for Albert Einstein. Einstein had invented the atomic bomb, abused dogs, neglected his children. "There were many greater geniuses than Einstein," said a Bulgarian freshman who had stopped by to borrow my copy of Dostoevsky's The Double. "Alfred Nobel hated mathematics and didn't give the Nobel Prize to any mathematicians. There were many who were more deserving." "Oh," I handed him the book. "Well, see you around." "Thanks," he said, glaring at the poster. "This is the man who beats his wife, forces her to solve his mathematical problems, to do the dirty work, and he denies her credit, and you put his picture on your wall." "Listen, leave me out of this," I said. "It's not really my poster. It's a complicated situation." He wasn't listening. "Einstein in this country is synonymous with genius, while many greater geniuses aren't famous at all. Why is this, I'm asking you?" I sighed. "Maybe it's because he's really the best and even jealous mudslingers can't hide his star quality," I said. "Nietzsche would say that such a great genius is entitled to beat his wife." That shut him up. After he left, I thought about taking down the poster. I wanted to be a courageous person, uncowed by other people's dumb opinions. But what was the dumb opinion? Thinking Einstein was so great, or thinking he was the worst? In the end, I left the poster up.
I'm gonna stop there. Thanks.
And we got another one.
And how thinly veiled is that account? Did you have an Einstein poster?
Oh yes, I did have
an
Einstein
and
poster.
And with the tongue.
It wasn't the tongue. He was just. I totally remember it. Yeah, I think he was wearing an overcoat.
Right. Yeah. And yesterday we spoke. There's sort of a finite number of posters that are available to college.
Yeah, there were like 20 of them.
Yeah. Can you think of any others?
Roy Lichtenstein, the dog, the Rothkos, the Mark Rothkos.
Right.
There were the Gauguins. There were the Van Goghs.
Yeah.
Campbell's soup can.
To signal my interest in the rest of the world at Gauguin.
Yeah. That was good. Well played.
Yes. The book's epigraph is from Proust, In Search of Lost Time, and I'm just going to read it, and I wonder if we can talk a little bit about it, and then I thought it'd be a perfect segue into talking about the cover of your book, because we're here talking about visual culture in part. The epigraph is, "In later life, we look at things in a more practical way, in full conformity with the rest of society, but adolescence is the only period in which we learn anything." So, were you reading Proust at that time, or what? How did this come to frame?
Well,
the novel?
I wrote this book, so this is very closely based on some experiences that I had in 1995 and 1996, and I wrote a novel about it in 2000, 2001, and then it was really long, and it went on and on, and it was we were just talking about shame, but it was very embarrassing. It was like a novel full of a person doing dumb things, and then by that point, I'd had 1 year of comp lit grad school. I'd done a 1 year of a PhD program, so I had a critical vocabulary, and I knew the difference between a protagonist and a narrator. So I was constantly I'm much smarter than this person I'm writing about. Anyway, so it didn't end. I broke my arm. I didn't have health insurance, and I went back to grad school. I got really into Russian literature and wrote this other book. And then I was trying to write a novel in 2015 that was going to be called The Two Lives. And it was super overdue, and I was in Tuscany, at this accidental fellowship, surrounded by pug dogs, and I kept having flashbacks to the person's college life, and I was I wrote this book in about college, and then I could look and my memories would be fresh, because otherwise I'm age 38 sitting in Italy trying to remember what were the lunch trays it was. So I had it in the cloud, and then I downloaded it. And at that point, I was reading Proust. I was going to be in Tuscany rereading Proust. But I mean, I'm saying this ironically, but I was in Tuscany rereading Proust, and it was amazing. And yeah, it's such a wonderful book. Anyway, so I got to that part, and it's so the whole quote is at this time in our lives, we go through, when we're young, we think that we're surrounded by gods and monsters.
And there's later in life, there's basically nothing that we've done at that time that we wouldn't give anything to annul. And yet at that time, that's the only time when we're capable of learning anything. And then I realized that that was the alive part of this book that I'd written, and that the part that was kind of not really working was the part that I'd written from the perspective of like a smarter person looking back. And that actually, if you took away all of that apparatus of being smarter and just kind of left all of the mistakes, that those mistakes were also the place where whatever I had lost that was in this, that I didn't have anymore at age 38, that was of any value or interest to me, was in those parts about the mistakes. And that's when I decided to call it The Idiot, and that's when I gave it that epigraph.
Is there a kind of nostalgia for that unsullied, naive self? The I don't know why the rock is idiotic, but it...
It is, right? It is. It's funny because...
But it's other things, too.
Yeah. I mean, you say dumb as a rock. And then it also reminded me, there's a Mayakovsky poem where he talks about... in general, I think he was kind of like a big guy, like really handsome, but like kind of... And so like he has this image of being kind of like a clod or an idiot. An idiot, I mean, obviously it's a... After I broke my arm, I did a PhD in Russian literature, so that's all like in one ear. But yeah, and so obviously the idiots are very present in Russian literature. But there's a line that he has that, what could such a clod want, though a clod many things? What could such a clod desire, though a clod many things? And this idea of like the clod, or like just a rock that is nonetheless full of all of these desires and thoughts, is like very kind of moving to me. And also kind of reminds me of that epigraph, because like, I don't know, or like teaching undergraduates, which is an experience I think you've had, but like you look at the room of them and you're like, they're all just like kind of, but like, you know, they're like thinking all of this stuff in there. Yeah.
No, full of potential.
Yeah, they're full of potential.
Yeah.
And like, you don't really have the language to talk to each other. And that's another thing that I realized when I was editing and rereading this, is that there's a lot of scenes where she's in a class and she doesn't understand what's going on. And she's like, this professor is asking all this stuff that's not the point. And I realized that like the teachers and the students are just speaking. So by the time I was reading it, I was more in tune with the professor's language, and I'd forgotten what it was like to be the clod.
So you reconnected with
With my inner clod. And then I got a picture of it in the mail. It was amazing. Yeah. They were like, okay, just look at it. Don't say anything yet. We think you're going to like, I think they were scared that I wouldn't like it. And then I was like, I love the rock. I had really mixed feelings about the pink. And then I asked to see it in a lot of different colors.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, no, it's great.
And are there rights issues associated
with rocks?
No. Dostoevsky's The Idiot.
I'm actually being sued by that rock's uncle.
That was my second.
There aren't in America, but there are in Germany. But fortunately, in German, idiot is gendered, so it's just called like the lady idiot. And then that's not Dostoevsky's title. And in America, I think it's out of the copyright.
Like, it was so long ago.
Yeah, it was so long ago.
More than 50 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, I wanted to come back to art, faith a little bit.
Yeah.
So Selin takes a class called Constructed Worlds. Mm-hmm. Did you take that class?
I sure did. Yeah.
And that poor professor, because he's sort of this caricature of maybe a struggling artist who's unsatisfied. He thinks of curators as like these shamans who define the narrative, and he's obviously feels marginalized. At some point, he encourages you guys to go to the Natural History Museum and ask about what the curators are hiding from the public.
Yeah.
And then she takes a class, a nonfiction film seminar, and watches a film called Man of... We both don't know how to pronounce this.
We don't know.
Aron.
Aron.
Do you guys, who knows that film? It's a classic of ethnographic film. from the 1930s. Yeah, about like a pre-modern society off the coast of Ireland. I'd read about it because I've studied anthropology. I was inspired to watch the whole thing on YouTube. You told me you haven't watched it since you were 18.
I haven't watched it since.
But I thought we might watch a little clip of it, because, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about why this is such a significant moment in ethnographic film.
Okay,
the backstory, if you remember.
Yeah. I can just read that part.
Oh, you can read that part.
I can read that part.
Should we watch this first?
Let's watch it first,
okay, and then read.
Okay.
Thank you.
probably good. It's really dramatic. And it goes on and on. So maybe you can read that.
Okay, yeah. I think it was.
But that was they were spearing a shark or a whale. A whale, maybe.
I don't know why it had that fin.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
So yeah, she's in a seminar about called Form in the Nonfiction Film.
We watched Man of Arran, a silent movie from the 1930s set on an Irish island. First, a woman rocked a baby in a cradle. This went on for a long time. Next, a man harpooned a whale and then scraped something with a knife. The intertitle read, Making Soap. Finally, the man and woman dug in the ground with sticks. The people of Arran must farm for potatoes in the inhospitable soil. Never in my life had I seen such a boring movie. I chewed 9 consecutive sticks of gum to remind myself I was still alive. The boy in front of me fell asleep and started to snore. The professor didn't notice because he himself had left after the first half hour. I've already seen this film several times, he said. In class, the professor told us that by the time of the film's making, 50 years had passed since the people of Arran had stopped harpooning whales. To capture the ancient practice on film, the director had imported a harpoon from the British Museum and instructed the islanders in its use. Knowing this, the professor asked, could we rightly classify the film as nonfiction? We had to debate this question for an hour. I couldn't believe it. That was the difference between fiction and nonfiction? That was something you were supposed to care about?
I guess it stopped there.
Talk a little bit about that difference between fiction and nonfiction and the slippage. And I think in the past you've spoken about how there is a hunger for people to write personal writing.
Yeah.
And obviously your flabby book, it's very long, mm-hmm. Is a great defense of the novel.
So can
we perhaps talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, I mean, now that I look at that passage, I think that that's actually a really interesting question, and I would enjoy talking about that with someone who knew something about film, which I guess is an experience, like an opportunity I had, you know, 20 years ago that I didn't really appreciate at the time. I started to try to write a sequel to this book. And at the time that I was doing the publicity for it, I got a lot of questions about why I had decided to call it a novel and not a memoir. And I was kind of like hedging the extent to which it was autobiographical because I just felt like it wasn't really anyone's business and it shouldn't matter. And like, so I had this idea that the way that we talk about fiction and nonfiction is not really correct because like my other job is I work for the New Yorker and I do nonfiction reported articles for them and those are fact checked and someone calls everyone on the phone and you know you make sure that you have a consensus view of what's going on. And my feeling about nonfiction is you're going on the record and saying, you know, to the best of my abilities, this really happened. Everyone in it kind of knows what's going on. We try to contact everyone. And this is the story as best we could find it. And with fiction, I feel like there's a like the received idea is, oh, fiction is invented, it's made up. But actually what I think fiction is you're not making a truth claim and you're just saying it doesn't matter if this happened or not. And you're, of course, you're welcome and perhaps doomed to wonder, but that's not a part of the book. So I just didn't really want to talk about that part of it. And then I went through a year of my life talking about how the difference between fiction and nonfiction doesn't really matter. And so now I'm trying to write the sequel, but I've realized that I think it's going to be actually sort of an essay collection about the difference between fiction and nonfiction. Because like the question annoyed me so much that it just seemed out of all proportion with what the question actually was. And I think it's something that I have to go back and investigate a lot because I have very mixed feelings about it.
I guess I thought, because we don't have a huge amount of time, I thought maybe we would transition to, so as I was reading this book, I was often thinking, I told you I read it every day at the gym in like 30-minute bursts. And so Céline was someone that kept me company for those 30 minutes, and she was a big part of my life. And very often I was thinking, what would Céline do, think, say? She's very present and compelling. And I wondered if we could do a little thought experiment with some art and maybe look at a few artworks and just think aloud as to what she would make of these artworks.
Yeah.
And maybe the next slide. Some of you in the room know an artist called Darren Bader, and Darren Bader is a conceptual artist. He's a sculptor. I think one of his great subjects is language. This is an artwork that I own. It was gifted to me, and it looks suspiciously like the cover of your book, actually. But it's just a rock. And there's
my lawyer call him. Yeah. You can have my rock's lawyer call him.
And this is a certificate. And so, as you can see, Darren has dictated the work can be put anywhere. It's worth some amount of money. I don't know exactly, but certainly maybe more than your rock. But maybe the next slide. And I just thought perhaps we could play a little thought experiment about what Céline would make of a few Darren Bader artworks. I think the next one is called Lasagna on Heroin. Yeah, so this is an artwork. It was sold at Sadie Cole's gallery. It's called Lasagna on Heroin. Maybe the next one? And this is called Cat Filled with Dirty Laundry. I don't know, Elif, does anything come to mind vis-a-vis, like, these are...
Yeah.
You know, this is a very important artist.
Yeah.
And is it stupid?
No, you know, the thing that comes to my mind is, like, writing this book in a way, it really brought me in touch with my childhood, I guess, because it was quite recent. And when you're a freshman in college, like, all your examples are from childhood. And looking at those two, the lasagna on the heroin and the cat full of laundry, where they're telling you that something is concealed, it really reminds me of... I had a pediatrician's appointment when I was a little kid, and my mom, who's also a small character in this book, which she's not super thrilled about, but she was convincing me to go to this pediatrician appointment. And once, apparently, we had gone to the pediatrician, and they gave me a Dixie cup of water that had Donald Duck on it, and I was like, well, are they at least going to have the Donald Duck Dixie cups? And she said, yes, of course. And then we went there, and instead of the Donald Duck Dixie cups, they had these, which actually reminds me of this grass a little bit. It was, I don't know if you guys remember, like, the early 80s, there were, like, these Dixie cups that had, like, kind of three-tone red, yellow, and orange reeds on them. It had that, and I was like, I felt so betrayed. I was like, I was told there would be Donald Duck, and my mom said, Donald Duck is behind that grass. And I really believed it, and, like, I told her that years later, and she didn't remember that at all. And she's like, I can't believe I would have said that. And then she's like, that sounds
brilliant.
Like me. But yeah, I mean, like, the laundry's in the cat. Where's the laundry? It's in the cat. Where's the heroin? It's under the lasagna. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
There's a kind of...
There's one more work. I think it's called French Horn with Guacamole.
Oh, see, this is different.
But that's more literal.
Yeah, you can see it. I mean, that one reminded me more of Céline's whole vibe, because I was really into Almodovar at that point, and there was, like, a lot of, like, gazpacho and guacamole and unexpected places, and, like, the colors, like, that avocado green was, like, very present in the 90s. Although this is, I guess, kind of anachronistic, because it wouldn't have existed back then. But if you brought her to the future and showed her this and said, this is what's going on in 2012, I think she'd be, like, right on.
No, I think she has the attributes of a great art historian. She's extremely observant. So I thought perhaps the next thing so I think this book is very much about form and media and mediums, and email is a big, as I said at the beginning, I don't know if you want to read that first paragraph of the book.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, yeah, it's
sure.
So beautiful, or the first page.
Yeah, just the opening.
So it's Céline's encounter with email, and then I thought we might talk about email, because it's something that we all obviously use and
suffer with. Yeah. This is just the very beginning of the book. I didn't know what email was until I got to college. But should I start there, or should I start at
I like the beginning.
The beginning, okay. I had heard of email and knew that in some sense I would have it. You'll be so fancy, said my mother's sister, who had married a computer scientist, sending your emails. She emphasized the E and paused before mail.
That summer, I heard email mentioned with increasing frequency. Things are changing so fast, my father said. Today at work, I surfed the World Wide Web. One second, I was in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. One second later, I was in Anıtkabir. Anıtkabir, Atatürk's mausoleum, was located in Ankara. I had no idea what my father was talking about, but I knew there was no meaningful sense in which he had been in Ankara that day, so I didn't really pay attention. On the first day of college, I stood in line behind a folding table and eventually received an email address and temporary password. The address had my last name in it, Karada, but all lowercase and without the Turkish soft G, which was silent. From an early age, I had understood that a silent G was funny. The G is silent, I would say in a weary voice, and it was always hilarious. I didn't understand how the email address was an address or what it was short for. What do we do with this, hang ourselves? I asked, holding up the Ethernet cable. You plug it into the wall, said the girl behind the table. Insofar as I'd had any idea about it at all, I had imagined that email would resemble faxing and would involve a printer. But there was no printer. There was another world. You could access it from certain computers, which were scattered throughout the ordinary landscape and looked no different from regular computers. Always there, unchanged, in a configuration nobody else could see, was a glowing list of messages from all the people you knew and from people you didn't know, all in the same letters, like the universal handwriting of thought or of the world. Some messages were formally epistolary, with dear and sincerely. Others telegraphic, all in lowercase with missing punctuation, like they were being beamed straight from people's brains. And each message contained the one that had come before, so your own words came back to you. All the words you threw out, they came back. It was like the story of your relations with others, the story of the intersection of your life with other lives, was constantly being recorded and updated, and you could check it at any time.
Love that. So email is another constructed world in a sense, because people have email personas.
Mm-hmm.
And so Celine and Yvonne have this quite, not quite lustful, but, you know, romantic exchange by email. And at some point she says, she thinks to herself, why was it more honorable to reread and interpret a novel like Lost Illusions than to reread and interpret some email from Yvonne? Was it because Yvonne wasn't as good a writer as Balzac? So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about email as a form and your first encounter with it, and also,
Well, so in the introduction, I love that you called this a historical novel. So at the time that I wrote it, I didn't know it was a historical novel. I just thought it was like about life. And then I reread it in 2015, and I was like it hadn't been that much time, right? Well, I guess it had been 20 years, right, since 1995. But it was a historical novel, and the thing that was the most different was the description of email. And actually, Nagar, you mentioned in your email the movie You've Got Mail, and it was a very dear friend of mine. We were talking about email, and she was like, you know, there was a time when email was this wonderful surprise, and like You've Got Mail could be a romantic comedy, and now it would be a horror movie. And it's just the whole way that we think and interact with email has changed. But at that time, like, it hadn't become bureaucratized, like your classes and your sections and your doctor's appointments, like none of that stuff came over email. It was something that almost had no reason to exist. You just came there and you got an email address and they didn't really tell you what to do with it. And you were like, what do I do with this, hang myself? And they're like, yep, go have fun. And then you're all of these like socially awkward kids. So Celine and Yvonne, who are these two people who really are not very socially gifted or like good at expressing themselves in real time, start like writing each other these like kind of pretentious emails. And that's what it's, but it seems like they get to invent the rules as it goes, and they're both kind of looking to the other one for what the rule is.
And what does he say at some point? He says, I'm in love with your email, the person who wrote these emails?
The person, he's like, wait, he says something really douchey. It's, he's like, the person who I love is the one who writes your emails.
Right.
And she's like, well,
which
who
is
do you
as
think
good
that
as
is?
Rejection.
Yeah. And she's like, well, who do you think that is? But then she's also like, well, who is that? Because they do all come in this kind of like denatured handwriting. Right. And like, and so she doesn't really understand how email works. So she leaves. This whole second half of the book is over the summer where she and Ivan kind of get separated, even though she goes to Hungary to try to like learn about him because he gets her job there. But she doesn't know what email is, and she thinks you can only check it from these particular computers. So she thinks of it as this like world that is existing somewhere that she just doesn't have access to that whole time. Right. So it's just, it is kind of geographic, and it's just completely different from how we think about it now, which I'd forgotten until I
No, it's everywhere.
It. Yeah, it's now seamless, it's everywhere. But, yeah.
Yeah.
It's in my pocket right now.
Yes. So for those of you who haven't read the book, there's also, I mean, there's clearly a love story. Mm-hmm. It's deeply unsatisfying. Because
so
if
I'm
you're
told.
One of those people who are flipping forward for the sex scene, yeah. Can I just say there's no sex scene?
Yeah.
There is a masturbation.
There is a masturbation scene. Yeah. Yes. Spoiler
but it's,
alert.
It's deeply, you know, hidden.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
Like, I almost missed it. And we were talking a little bit, so, and Céline talks a little bit about...
It must have been 3 to 4 screens on your phone. Yeah. I could have missed it.
And you've talked a little bit about, and Céline also has this sensation of feeling outside of narrative.
Yeah.
And so she wants to be a writer. She's got, you know, a sort of the canon of great books. She's puzzling through it all. This book itself, I was flipping forward for the sex scene or the climactic something, the resolution. There isn't
you
much
and Dwight
of,
Garner.
Yes. Did he? I don't. I didn't.
The review was that right. They did. The review in the Times was like, "You guys, they don't have sex and it's horrible. Like, what are they gonna screw?"
Yes. Yeah.
B minus.
Yeah, but it keeps you. It keeps you involved in the book until the end because you're.
Yeah.
Other things keep you involved as well. So there's no happy ending, there's no climactic anything, and I just wonder if we can loop back to that first quote that I read that was sort of in defense of untidy narratives, and I just wonder, did you go into this knowing if they would have sex, or if there would be, or how it would end?
I mean, I went into it knowing how my life went. I definitely crossed my mind. So one of the things that I was... trying to write about was the feeling that I had. Okay, so when I went back and I was editing this book, it was this like long, it was like 400,000 words. It was like 4 times longer than this. It was like really, really, like this is already quite long, and so it was really, really long. And the reason that I wasn't able to finish it was because I couldn't tell what the beginning was and what the end was. So it had a lot of flashbacks and flash forwards. I was writing it in San Francisco, and San Francisco was in it, and there was like a lot of stuff about like, I don't know, detectives and like Native American. There was just like a whole lot of stuff in it. And then when I went back and looked at it as an older person, it was clear to me that it was a campus novel, that it was about those 12 months. It wasn't about stuff that happened 6 years later or whatever. It was a campus novel that started as a campus novel and then went off the tracks, and then also it was a historical novel. And I remembered this feeling that I had from being that age of falling outside of narrative, which was something that I hadn't put in those words, but it was this. So I think there's some people in the world, there's a group of people in the world to which I belong. I think a lot of readers do, where you think of your life as a story and you're always trying to match your life against this story. And when you're younger, especially, there can be times where you're living your life. I mean, wait, what was it that I was just... Oh, yeah, I was just listening to Esther Perel talk about affairs and how like the most traumatic thing that happens is that your partner changes the story, and that losing the story that you thought you were in is like the most painful thing. And I think that's also like a lot of stuff where you write something and someone you wrote about gets angry at you. It's because you've like messed up the story that was in their head. But so I remembered this feeling that I had of being younger, where I would feel like my life had been running on the tracks of a story, and then it just went off, and suddenly it was like I didn't know what was going to happen anymore. So in this book, I wanted to describe the feeling that she thinks that she's in this story with this guy, Ivan, and then somehow things don't go the way that she wants them to or expects them to, and it feels like Ivan has gone off somewhere. He goes to Japan at the end, and it's like he takes the story of her life with her, and then she's still in Hungary, which is somewhere where she went to learn more about him, but he's not there anymore. It's just full of millions of Hungarian people who aren't him, so what can she learn? But then, like, she also has to keep interacting with them, and there's various, like, you know, ethical responsibilities that you have as a person surrounded by other people to like interact with them and to like, you know, maintain your face as a human face. And all of those decisions have to be made kind of from scratch in a way. So I wanted to describe that feeling, which is not a pleasant feeling at all, which I'm sure some part of that gets brought across the reader. But in another way, I think that that's kind of like the job of the novel. Like for me, the novel, like the rules of the novel are set by Don Quixote, and it's a book about this guy who's like, I know what I want my life to be like. I leave the house in the morning and I kill a giant, and then I come home and I tell the princess and like everything's great, and then like it just doesn't happen that way, and he ends up in this kind of like free fall, which is kind of funny and kind of sad, and it does kind of tend toward this picaresque, okay, let me try again, let me go out tomorrow. So that's what I was thinking about.
And there's this interesting, so Svetlana, who's such a winning character, her best friend, sidekick, makes this distinction between herself, who lives an ethical life, and Selin, who lives an aesthetic life. So there is a sense, but not in an annoying way, that she's collecting
Material for her future book,
So, but when you say that you envisage yourself in a novel, not a movie, is it always a novel? Because I think most people
think of themselves in a movie.
Yeah.
I grew up, like, we had a shitty TV. We didn't really have a VCR until I was in my teens, and I read a lot of books, so I didn't see a movie until I was 22. Just kidding.
Was it that one?
Of course I'd seen movies. I saw Annie 17 times. I think sometimes I thought of myself.
Right. And the last, because I'm assuming, where's Amy? I'm assuming we have to sort of start to get to questions, but yeah. But the end of the book, can you read the last line of
the book?
And then maybe we could talk a little bit about...
Okay. Last line's very exciting.
And maybe talk a little bit about language as well.
When I got back to school in the fall, I changed my major from linguistics and didn't take any more classes in the philosophy or psychology of language. They had let me down. I hadn't learned what I had wanted to about how language worked. I hadn't learned anything at all.
432 pages later. That's my spoiler. Would it make sense to open up to questions now, do you think? Or is that good for you?
Sorry?
Good for you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
So actually, I'm a Harvard undergrad thinking about writing a campus novel for my thesis.
Awesome.
I have a
double question.
Okay, yeah, but I'm a social studies major, and I'm pretty sure the director of my program will hate it. Should I go for it? The second part of my question is, have you written, published or posted anything about, like, your writing process for this book in particular? Because I always love reading, like, how writers did their work, and that would be practically useful, and, like, I think it would be interesting. So have you, like, written anything up about, I don't know, thoughts about how you worked on the book or your goals, what you tried to accomplish with it, or details about the writing process?
No, I haven't written anything like that. If you go to my webpage, there's a page of interviews. They're pretty annoying, but they're like, I don't know if there's a way to text search all of them, but I definitely yammered on about it at some point. I'm working on writing something like this book that's going to be about fiction and nonfiction. So I think a lot of like how I think about fiction and nonfiction actually changed very recently with all the Me Too stuff. So this book that was supposed to be a continuation of this is going to be kind of about the experience of writing this. Also, some of the conversations that I've had with people who were like sort of characters in this book. And also just thoughts about genre and fiction and nonfiction, but that's going to take me forever, so you're going to probably be years out of your college education.
Got it. Well, anyway, I love that kind of stuff, so I guess I'll just, like, look forward
just
to it.
Stay tuned, yeah. Yeah, and about the social studies director, I don't really know. My sense is go for it.
Yeah, because I think I'm going to write, like, an essay kind of component that ties into it, so maybe, I don't know, but I'll look forward to reading your next book.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hi.
Hi.
I love the book. What's the most insane fact check you ever got from the New Yorker?
Oh, the most insane fact check I got from the New Yorker. You know, the New Yorker printed an excerpt of this, and they fact checked it. And they found so much stuff. Like, it was so full. Like, so Man of Aaron, I got a bunch of the intertitles wrong. Some of the geography of Boston was wrong. A museum that I mentioned didn't exist yet. Although I think they were wrong, because what, like, how would I, anyway. Let's see, what's most, I just did a story. I have a story in the April 30th issue about rental relatives in Japan, which you should all check out. And that was actually pretty, they just called the rental relatives on the phone and they were like, yup. I guess, so I did a story once about a subway line was being built between Europe and Asia and Turkey, and when they were excavating it, they found a bunch of Byzantine ships that were like freakishly well preserved because of like how the salt had flown in the sea or something, and then so they had filled in this missing chapter in the history of Byzantine shipbuilding, so like they had to be excavated, which took 7 years, and then after they finished getting out the ships, they were like, okay, now we're going to just do a survey of the seafloor, it's just a formality. And then they did that survey and they found like a Neolithic footprint. So then it turned out that like humans had been there like 8,000 years ago, which changed the history of like the land migration. And it like, so it was like 3 more years. And I interviewed an engineer who was talking about how like he'd started it as a young man. I mean, it's not like he was old, but like 10 years had passed and he had become bald. And he was just like, yeah, like I can just tell you that when they excavate something, I can just tell you from my experience, if they find something and it's Byzantine, you know, it's okay, just hold on. But if they find something Roman, you're just fucked. And then like, so I quoted him on that, and then they like, and I also mentioned he had a canary, and the canary's name was Joshkun, which means overflowing or like ebullient. So I mentioned that he had like and it was chirping constantly, and we were in this like tent on the grounds full of cigarette smoke because he was chained, so he was just like super stressed out. So I described the scene, and then the fact checker called him, and he was like, I thought I was being interviewed about like how many meters deep is the tunnel, tell me about the tunnel construction. And then, but when they got to the canary, he was like, my bird is in this? And then like, and so then the, they had like the a friend of mine who was working with me on the story, so I couldn't be in on the fact-checking call, but she like called him and she was like, okay, like Elif does this really specific kind of work. It's like not so much journalism, it's more like literature. And they had like all of these conversations, and like finally in the end he apparently said to them, I guess I understand, by the time you pass out of yourself into literature, there's no way you can control anything. And I felt really sad.
I mean, if no one else has a question, I wonder, you have a PhD in Russian literature. Your first book was called The Possessed, also a Dostoevsky novel.
Yeah.
It's really terrific. It's a collection of essays. If someone told me that there was a great book about getting a PhD in Russian literature, it sounds boring, but it's actually very compelling. But what has Russian literature taught you about, or how has it informed this book? And again, back to that question of form and what you in 2006 thought was wrong with American literature at some level. Mm-hmm. And this very much feels like a very tangible riposte in a way.
Yeah. Well, Russian literature meant, so in real life, I did study Russian in my first year of college, and that's a part of the book, and Ivan and Sidin talk about Dostoevsky. So there's like an idea that I had about what role Russian literature played in it at that time, but editing it and especially talking about it now, I have kind of a different way of looking at it. I see this as a book a lot about, more about the immigrant experience than I thought it was, and I think a lot of Sidin's kind of impatience and impatience with Harvard and with like, really, this is the important question that we're supposed to study, was based on like the real life feeling that I had. Like for my mom, it was super, super important for me to get into Harvard. And she went to the most famous medical school in Turkey, and then So in Turkey, she's like a, everyone knows that school. And then she came here and people are like, oh, where are you from again? Lebanon? And she was like, so I had this idea that like, I'm going to become a writer, and not just in some backwater way, but in like a really universal way. And I'm going to go to like the best school. And it was like this idea that I got from my parents, which was really tied into Kemalism and this idea of Turkey, like joining the rest of the world and joining the universal. And the universal and the Western were kind of the same thing. And that was an idea that was not really examined that much at the time. But now, of course, has been hugely politicized, and now the Western is not viewed as the universal. The Western is viewed as elitist and anti-populist and not real. And that actually, that problematic between is the universal, is the Western the universal, or is the Western the elitist and the alienated, is actually like the central issue in most of Dostoevsky's novels. So now when I think, like at the time, my attraction to Russian literature was a lot because I grew up during the Cold War. I had this feeling that America was kind of frivolous. I didn't care for like childhood and fun. And like, and my mom especially was really, she was like, in America, children can be children and they're not burdened with like dying people the minute that they're, you know, they turn 8. And I was like, where are the dying people? I want to be part of real life. And like, so I had this idea that like Russia was like where life was still real and rigorous. But I think that looking back, I think part of the appeal to me was that it was problematizing this central issue for my parents that they didn't really talk about, but that I felt. And we went back to Turkey every summer, and I think I was feeling it and just hadn't totally acknowledged it because, you know, then by that time it was the 90s and it was the end of history and we weren't thinking and talking about that anymore, but I am thinking about it now.
There's also, so there's a lot of adventures in linguistics in the book, and I can't remember, what is it called, the Sepur, what is it? I've learned it.
Sepur and Worf.
Yeah.
Or Sepur, I don't know how to say it.
Important idea in linguistics, which basically it hinges on the idea that perhaps we think differently in different languages, is that right?
That is, yeah.
Are you just nodding? Okay.
Yeah.
And I just to continue from what you were just saying, you grew up speaking Turkish and English and negotiating these two worlds, and I just wonder how much that, it comes up in this book.
It does. So the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is that language does not shape our view of reality, and I grew up feeling very strongly that language did shape our view of reality, but so does time shape our view of reality. And I think that we might be running out of it. So thank you so much for these wonderful questions. And this has been such a pleasure.